Rob Wolf, Andy Dees, today is a big day, episode 20, finally.
Holy cats, we're almost of legal drinking age in episode terms.
I'm waiting for when we get hit 100 and you can come up with something better than holy cats, but I like it. I like it for today.
I'm highly repetitious. It's reflective of me essentially being a four-year-old, so.
I was actually thinking the other day, someone had, several weeks ago, made a comment on the blog about words they've picked up from you, like dealio and a bunch of other things. I was thinking, we used to have this guy that I worked for, and he had, like, you know, all these sayings, and he was in his 50s that he had crafted over his 30 years in corporate America. We used to keep track and, like, walk around and make little notes because they were hysterical, and you can tell he had used them, you know, for years and years and years. And you're going to be like that someday, Rob.
Actually, mine's the opposite. Mine are all stupid, and it's actually it's actually whittling away a legitimate, base of knowledge and verbal acuity in favor of things like dealio and holy cats. So it's actually rotting your brain. So
you're replacing.
That's the best I can do.
It's all that pseudoscience.
Exactly. Exactly.
So once again, 1 week closer to the book. So, well, to your self-imposed book submission deadline. So
that's just shout out. To my editors, the exercise chapter, the ancestral fitness chapter, and then also the tracking progress chapter. So hopefully get some feedback on that. Did a Facebook update, and we spent about an hour and a half talking with the publisher and then some wholesalers who basically go out and sell the books to, you know, like Barnes & Noble and all that sort of stuff. And normally those things only take about 15 minutes, but we actually ended up spending an hour and 10 minutes on the phone, and they were super excited. Had a couple of the women who were on the call, they jumped in, and they're going to do a 30-day kind of paleo challenge and do before and after photos. So they seemed really fired up. So closer and closer each day, we'll see. Like I keep saying, I'm going to be drunk for a week when it's all done. So
I think that's a good start, man. Drunk for a week. You got to celebrate that kind of stuff. It's only been 5 years in the making, at least.
So. I know. Seriously.
Other thing I wanted to mention, Rob, is I'm going to post a link on the show notes celebrating the whole nine Rob Wolf fish oil calculator that our friends Melissa and Dallas put together, combining your knowledge and their love of spreadsheets.
That's awesome. I was actually going to do a blog post on it too, and had just not got around to it. It's been open in my browser for like a week, but that would be awesome.
Yeah, because I think that's very cool and a little simpler than, you know, 1 gram of EPA DHA per 10 pounds of body weight, et cetera, et cetera. They make it nice and customizable based on what type of fish oil you're taking. They have some nice lifestyle factors, which I thought was really cool. And I think it's an easy way for folks to figure out where they are as far as fish oil dosage.
It is genius. And the fact that they attributed it to me is very, very generous. And Dallas and Melissa are great. What can you say?
Just goes to show, Rob, that some people put things together better than you, because you could have whipped this together in Excel like 4 years ago.
Oh, man. Everybody puts things better together than I do. So, yeah.
It takes Dallas and Melissa to sit around and be like, you know what? We should just make a little app so that people can do this on their own on the internet. Look how easy that is. All right, cool. Well, the first question, Rob, we're actually going to skip today, which
yes.
Odd that we're talking about, but I'm going to let you give your reason for skipping and what we're going to do for our friend Miss Spinach before I try to misread any words or anything.
Yeah, Miss Spinach had a great question talking about, I think it was about two podcasts back, when somebody asked about eating peanuts and being able to downregulate peanut allergy from, you know, small exposures. And I was going to need to do some research on that. And then Mike Malloy actually shot me an email and just kind of, bam, laid all this stuff out there, which saved me a ton of research. But what I'm going to need to do is actually write all this stuff out on a board, because we're going to have to do some basic immunology, like talk about the different cells involved and what they do. And it's a very interesting concept, and I think it's worthwhile to understand it, because this is all a lot of the same stuff that underlies autoimmunity and leaky gut and the autoimmune response. So it is worthwhile getting into and understanding it, but it's going to take a little background. And if I just verbally rattle this stuff off, it's going to sound like I'm saying IgE and IgG like 50,000 times, and it's just not going to make any sense except to like Mike and two other people with an immunology background. So Sarah, we're actually going to do this whole thing, draw it out. It'll be an at the whiteboard moment, and Andy and I are liable to, I don't know, we may need some sort of a penalty or something. Like if we flub something, we have to do a shot of tequila or something like that and see how the thing degenerates from start to finish. But we'll do a good job on it, and then we'll be able to understand this whole process, theoretically.
That's the first question we've skipped and had an explanation for. So I think this is a monumental occasion for the 20th episode.
Yeah.
All right, cool. first question we're going to do today is from Jay. He said he's been hearing on the performance menu boards that the benefits from fish oil are due to the DHA and not the EPA, and that EPA is actually immune suppressing and increases lipid
peroxidation.
Once again, Rob, this is why you're here. I did some Googling and found a lot of info supporting this statement as well. Another thing they talk about a lot is the PCB content of fish oil, as PCBs and other toxic pesticides accumulate in fat, unlike heavy metals, which accumulate in protein. Given these two arguments, a lot of these people conclude that algae-derived DHEA is the best way to get the benefit fish oil has, but without toxins and without the so-called damaging EPA. Can you comment on this?
Sure. So the two essential fats that we need are EPA and DHA. Any type of long-chain polyunsaturated fat is going to increase lipid peroxidation. This is a reactive oxygen species. It's the oxidative damage that happens in fats. This is also part of why saturated fats are kind of intriguing, because they block this feed-forward mechanism. Lipid peroxidation tends to happen. It's almost a chain reaction type of mechanism. Most biological mechanisms, when there's some sort of damage going on, there are control mechanisms that kind of shut it down. Lipid peroxidation, particularly if you have a lot of polyunsaturated fats, can just go on and on and on. It can be very, very damaging. Saturated fats actually kind of quench this whole process, which there are some folks out there, this is why they recommend high amounts of saturated fat in the diet, because theoretically it should be a lower oxidative stress type diet. You could certainly make some arguments for that. This is also why things like corn oil are so incredibly nasty, because it's full of shorter chain polyunsaturated fats, both of the omega-3 and the omega-6 varieties. So they're just horrible. They're very pro-inflammatory, and one of the main reasons is the lipid peroxidation factor. So any type of fat is going to be problematic. EPA does have immunosuppressing action, but so does vitamin D, but that doesn't mean that it's necessarily a bad thing. Some people were a little bit freaked out about vitamin D a while back. It suppresses abnormal amounts of immune expression. I forget if it was Mike Malloy, the guy that just shot the email about the IgEs and the upregulation, downregulation of sensitivity with things like peanuts, or if it was someone else. I forget who the email came in from, but they were talking about vitamin D and its role in modulating the immune response in things like the H1N1 flu. And a lot of the reason, he was theorizing, and I've kind of thought about this too, the reason why that H1N1 flu is fatal in some people is that those people have too much inflammation going on all the time. And so the flu ends up causing an immune response, and that immune response ends up going overboard. There's what's called a cytokine storm, and it ends up effectively killing you. So the EPA is actually very mitigating on those kind of cytokine storms. So from my perspective, EPA is still really important, and we know that because EPA and DHA are interchangeable, interconvertible, and so if we are needing more EPA, then the body can convert DHA into EPA, which leads into his other statement or question, would a better way to go about getting all this stuff go from an algae-derived DHA source, that might be fine. Like that might be an okay way to go. I have not looked too much at either the mechanisms or the research that would be involved with having almost exclusively DHA source, although you would still be getting some out of like meat and fish and stuff like that. But I think that would probably be fine, but that would take a little bit more tinkering to figure out for sure. Certainly, as kids, our primary source is DHA that we get out of these two fatty acids. We get a preponderance of DHA. The EPA is sieved out of the breast milk. And so, you know, you could make an argument that it would be fine in that regards. It's definitely better for neurological action, but the EPA definitely has some anti-inflammatory effects that we like on a more systemic level.
When will people stop hating on fish oil, Rob?
Never, never. You know, it's interesting stuff. And when I was driving in the office today, there was a piece on NPR. And NPR just kind of rankles me at times, but it was a pretty good deal, you know, talking about like the health of the oceans, and a lot of what they were focusing on was actually plastics and the gargantuan plastic load that we are leaching into the marine environment. And it's pretty terrifying. And having spent a fair amount of time in Nicaragua the last couple of years, like it's amazing how remote you can be, literally out in the middle of nowhere, and a storm happens and a ton of, you know, plastic type residue ends up on the beaches. None of this stuff biodegrades currently. It just bioaccumulates in the system. That will eventually bite us in the ass in various regards. So like it's just something to kind of think about the quality of all this stuff. It is still better. Most of the fish oils, if you're more reputable companies like Nordic Naturals, Carlson, stuff like that, tend to be much better processed. If they're getting the fish oil from smaller types of fish, then they have less bioaccumulation and all that. But, you know, maybe throwing that reminder out to folks to give a little thought to like the type of packaging that they're getting their food in, what type of bags they use. As much as we can, we try to leave some cotton totes in the car for dealing with hauling groceries home and all that sort of jive, not to turn it into a complete like eco freak out. But I think that stuff makes sense and a little goes a long way with it. Like I was horrified at how many plastic bags we'd accumulated in our drawer in the kitchen, and I took them in for recycling and all that, but it's still that it's kind of a silly deal. And in Europe, you just don't see that. Like those bags, I think they charge 5 or 10 cents a bag if you were to get those, or they don't offer them at all. Like you've got to bring your own tote, and it totally makes sense. And then we actually start dealing with some of these problems.
I don't know why we deal with them, Rob. They'll go away someday, or the planet will explode.
Well, like I said, it will all get recycled when the sun explodes and consumes the whole thing. So maybe we don't worry about it. So yeah.
All right. Cool. Good question.
Yeah.
Next, we got a question from Celiac Mom. Kind of a long intro, but I think I'm going to read it all. And then she has two or three questions at the end, so we will handle them one by one.
Cool.
Hi, Rob. Over the years, I've had numerous health battles, everything from skin rashes, skin cancer, reproductive problems, you name it. Then about a year ago, I attended one of your nutrition seminars. During that time, I made a very clear and distinct connection between the health issues I was facing and gluten. When I got back home, I found a doctor familiar with celiac disease, and I requested that he test me. Prior to that, I've been working with doctors literally for years trying to explain health issues that I've been having. Needless to say, I was diagnosed as being celiac. Prior to being celiac, I did eat well, very zone paleo-ish. However, my cheats always included gluten. Since I've gone 100% strictly off gluten and following the paleolithic way of eating, I have since gained 10 pounds. Is this normal? I'm currently not following a zone paleo method because I got too neurotic with weighing and measuring. It was not a healthy mindset for me. Currently just following paleo, I truly do not feel that I'm eating in excess. My mouth is my mouth and not a vacuum. Food is just fuel. I don't have emotional connections to it. However, my questions stem from the weight gain. Here is my background info. I am 135 pounds at 5'6" and in my mid-30s. I follow more of a max effort CrossFit football type of training. I train about 4 days a week doing a strength session followed by a short Metcon. I supplement with pharmaceutical grade fish oil, magnesium, vitamin D and C, and glucosamine. I've completely cut out dairy and gluten. I eat grass-fed meats. Parentheses, love my farmers. Fish, veggies, fruit, and very few nuts. My fats mostly come from olives, avocados, coconut oil, and olive oil. So, question one. Do you think the weight gain may have to do with my body being undernourished for so many years due to the autoimmunity shutdown by having gluten in my system? At first, I thought this immediate weight gain was a normal transition, but the weight is still staying on.
I think that's a safe bet. Malnutrition is one of the characteristics of celiac, and a host of other kind of GI problems that fall in that category. So the rebound weight gain is really, really normal. It's frustrating in some ways, but it's normal.
Okay. Question two, although I feel better and performing better, I am not happy with how I look. I now have a small, pudgy middle. I do realize the realities of life. I have had several children, however. How do I get back to my desired weight without going neurotic or totally psycho about weighing and measuring? And or is there something I can cut out or supplement with to help with the process?
I think, you know, tackling it kind of lowish carb. Again, you know, maybe cutting out the fruit for the most part, keeping it relatively, you know, meat, veggies, fat. Then just kind of going a little easy on that. I mean, a little bit of mild caloric restriction. You don't have to necessarily break out the scales, but you just make sure that, you know, you eat a little bit less, and you tend to get some pretty good results off of that. We usually eat at a maintenance level, and sometimes we need to do a little bit of conscious effort to restrict that a bit. Simply restricting the carbohydrates may be enough. She might also consider throwing in that just old standard of like 150 micrograms of iodine. That's a standard RDA amount. But a lot of people with gluten intolerance and celiac disease also have some iodine deficiencies. And I forget who it was. Somebody wrote a piece on basic paleo eating also generally being a little skinny on iodine. And so that might be something to throw in the mix just to make sure that base is covered.
Cool. And number three, should I alter my approach to training and add in more Metcon? Ooh.
Good God, no. You're doing great. She's doing great. If she wanted to, you know, throw a nice long ramble a day or two a week and just get out and move, I think that would be great. But I think that stuff is fine. If at the end of a regular Metcon she wanted to do literally just some kind of long, slow distance activity, it's very Art Devaney-esque where you do that hard, heavy workout that releases a little bit of adrenaline, releases fat for fuel into the blood, and then you do some low-level kind of activity to use that stuff. Martin, the Lean Gains guy, talks about this at length. It's a smart, effective strategy, and it's just kind of classic bodybuilding fat loss. You know, you do a little bit of hard activity up front and then some low-level, non-lactate-forming cardio at the end.
Nice. And finally, she wraps up by saying, I appreciate your help. I'm confused as to how to approach this problem as I am healthier now and feeling great, but don't like the portion of looking good naked at the moment. Any thoughts or suggestions would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, and please realize you do so much for this community and it is greatly appreciated. Sorry for the long question. Listener number 8, question mark. Seriously, people, stop with the jokes. We're encouraging Rob.
I think we keep dropping people off, like the folks in the rest home keep dying, and so we're still hanging right around 6 listeners, I'm sure.
I just want to say, Rob, if we get to episode 100 and you're still using that joke and people are still encouraging you, I'm not sure what my response is going to be, but I don't think it's going to be positive. That's where
a hunger strike. I recommend a hunger strike. So.
A hunger strike. Nice.
And you write it for all it's worth. So
yes.
So great questions. And totally appreciate it. And if Celiac Mom gives that stuff a shot, please update us and let us know how that goes. Let us know if that works.
Cool. Good question.
Yeah.
Next, we got a question from Sue. She said, a friend's teenage son has obliterative bronchiolitis. Yep. Look at that. I got one right today.
You did indeed.
Black tea is kicking in, brother.
You're growing up so fast.
He is constantly having lung problems. Doctors treat the symptoms with a very expensive antibiotic called Zithromax, and he's being taken off it next month, even though his lungs are worse. Would vitamin 3 help with this, and what dose? Is 5,000 IU daily too much? Should he be tested for vitamin D deficiency before supplementing? What about cod liver oil?
The obliterative bronchiolitis has some characteristics that look very autoimmune. And so that whole autoimmune kind of protocol, you know, the improved sleep, gluten-free, dairy-free, paleo diet, the vitamin D, fish oil, all of that really makes sense. Certainly folks can check the vitamin D deficiency before supplementing. I think anything in that 2,000 to 5,000 IU realm is pretty safe, but I mean, it's a inexpensive, fairly easy blood test to get that to just verify. Slowly it's coming around that people need much higher levels of vitamin D than what we've previously thought. So, you know, I would generally think that that stuff would be safe to do, and I would be shocked if it did not help the condition.
Yeah. And no to cod liver oil.
Yeah, no to the cod liver oil, because the vitamin A ends up blocking the effects of the vitamin D potently.
Yes. Yeah. But there's always the Rob Wolf fish oil calculator / whole nine. I love how they gave, like, you're part of it. Like, they named it the Rob Wolf fish oil calculator. I'm so excited.
I was honored. I was hugely, hugely honored. So, if I ever had aspirations for anything, it might be the Rob Wolf, like, dust bunny collector or something like that. But this is truly amazing stuff.
Ah, yes. Don't let it go to your head, or Melissa and Dallas are going to remove your name.
Power hungry and dreaming of more stuff.
All right. Next, we got a question from Mike D. Rob, maybe you can use this in the... Oh, wait. I'm skipping one. Sorry, my favorite question.
Yeah, Justin.
That's right, Justin. Rob, question for the podcast. Rereading Lights Out. I'm so proud of this guy right now. Rereading Lights Out. I recommended it to someone else at the gym the other day, and they said, I tried to read it, Andy, and I fell asleep. And I'm like, well, it worked.
Yeah, totally.
Rereading Lights Out and giving some serious thought to the seasonal training idea. Given their recommendations on lowering carbs to 25 to 45 grams in the winter, might it make more sense to hit a mass gain starting strength protocol in the summertime when carbs and calories are more plentiful? Seems sort of counterintuitive. Everyone wants to be lean in the summer. What do you think?
I think it makes a lot of sense. You could tackle it in a way where you could still be relatively lean, you know, like a cyclic low carb kind of approach, but or at least a kind of a targeted ketogenic type thing where you're just doing carbs post-workout, which I think is a great way to go. Scotty Hagness did this last year, and I think put on about 15 pounds of muscle, like really beefed up and thickened up from this. Historically, I had always tackled this kind of seasonal eating and training kind of gig by doing just more Metcon type things in the summer and, you know, matching that activity with more carbs. And I think that works okay too. But Rutman, Michael Rutherford, pointed out and I forget the exact term for it. We might have to do a little digging, but that the bulk of the strength gains that an athlete makes, it's very tied to the seasonality, and that it's more the periods of maximum sun exposure is when people tend to make their best strength gains. And there might be some vitamin D underpinnings to it. Might be some other light exposure, but I forget the term for it, and knowledgeable strength coaches apparently are pretty savvy to this, and it was news to me, though. He told me about it about a year ago. We'll do some digging and try to plug that into the program notes, but it makes sense all the way around to tackle it that way, and I really like that seasonal eating approach, seasonal training approach. It forces some periodization and forces you to change gears and make some meet short, medium, and long-term goals and change up your training, which I think is great.
Cool. Good question.
Yeah.
Good book, as always.
Absolutely.
Now we're on the Mike D question.
There we go.
Must be the rapper from the Beastie Boys. Rob, maybe you can use this in the podcast. Can you expand on how leptin and other hormones work when it comes to hunger? I'm finding it hard to do the unweighed, unmeasured paleo gig, and I can't seem to eat to satiety. I can eat till I'm stuffed, but then I'm uncomfortably stuffed. There's no in-between. Also, I notice if I don't make a meal with some sort of starchy carb source, yam, squash, etc., I get ravenous an hour after I finish eating. I get hungry like all hell, and sometimes I'll even get a headache. This can be from meals ranging from 500 to 2,000 calories in a sitting. Doesn't matter. These meals generally include a good bit of protein, fat, and 4 to 6 cups of cooked veggies. If I add to that some fruit or yam, then the post-eating hunger isn't as bad. If I push through the hunger pains, I'm usually good for a few more hours, but that initial hit sucks hard. I'm 5'10", 180 at about 13% body fat, and have been strict paleo for the last 6 months, save for a few cheats a month. I do max ever black box style wads 3 to 5 times a week. I'm also coming off weighing 240 a year ago and being completely metabolically deranged. Not sure if that matters. The promise of hunger-free paleo eating has eluded me thus far. Thanks. Can't wait for the book. Keep fighting the good fight.
Holy cats, this is a good one. And, it, you know, we need to bring Matt Lalonde on here at some point, because this guy has just been crushing it with regards to really researching and understanding this whole leptin, insulin resistance, and all that. He can go on. And he shot me a number of PowerPoint presentations and some slides that really encapsulates this stuff. I think what Mike D has going on is still some after effects of his metabolic derangement, and he's still not managing insulin as effectively as what he could. What Matt explained to me, and what's becoming more clear to me, is that there are different routes of effectively, like the leptin resistance. We've got some autoimmune elements to it. We have a high intake of fructose and glucose, which feed into a production of triglycerides out of the liver, and then when the triglycerides are produced, that ends up making a spike of palmitic acid, which that actually causes transitory leptin resistance, and that leptin resistance then leads into insulin resistance. Insulin resistance first in the liver, and this is where fatty liver starts developing, and then it starts spreading kind of system-wide from there. And I think what we're seeing here is Mike has probably not fully reversed all that. And what we're also discovering is that depending on how much damage an individual has done to their pancreas, there's oxidative stress that can happen to the beta cells of the pancreas. And then there's also autoimmune damage that can happen. And what we're finding is that people who had kind of a type 2 diabetes sort of scenario where they're systemically insulin resistant, not responding well to insulin, they also have kind of a type 1 diabetes kind of phenomena going on, in which they are simply not responding well to carbohydrates. They're not able to manage the production of insulin well. It would be interesting to see what Mike's A1Cs and some other blood work would look like, because he may also still have some elevated cortisol response to food. There may still be some stress response to this. So a little bit of blood work would be interesting to be able to help nail this down. If he had high A1Cs, then we know that we maybe have a high cortisol issue that is still buggering the underlying insulin resistance. So there's a little bit of lab work that would really help make a recommendation with this. Usually, if people are, you know, some legitimately there are some people who just run better with a little bit more starch, a little bit more carbohydrate in their system. I find them to be maybe like 10% of the population at best. And most people, if you titrate them down to a protein, veggie, and fat kind of scenario, they look, feel, and perform really well on that. And it may legitimately be that Mike just runs a little bit better with the starchy carbs, but it would be interesting to see if some blood work would make all that a little more clear, and definitely looking at like triglycerides, A1Cs, and then possibly even doing like a glucose tolerance test to see how he does with that. That would tell us a lot about what his pancreas is doing and how it's responding to a bolus of glucose. And then the A1C would tell us how his body is dealing both with regards to cortisol and long-term carbohydrate metabolism. So there's more stuff that we would need to know to dial this in precisely. Like, is Mike legitimately just kind of more carbohydrate wired? But the fact that he's not able to, you know, like he gets really, really ravenously hungry after a meal kind of makes me think that he has some insulin mismanagement going on there.
All right. Good.
Yeah.
Let us know, Mike, if you actually end up getting any blood work done next time you go to the doctor. I'd be curious to see what that looks like.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right, next we got a question from Curious. That's original. Rob, I recently went to my GP, and he is taking additional tests, but believes my testosterone levels are too low for my age, now near 40, and wants me to start testosterone replacement therapy. The last blood test I had measured at 315. What are we measuring testosterone in?
Nanograms per deciliter.
Thank you.
Yes.
Are there natural methods to increase levels that actually work? Just curious as to what your thoughts, opinions, and or suggestions may be when I review the results and discuss the options with the doc. Thanks.
Vitamin D is a biggie with this. Not overtraining. Sleep is big. Tribulus, I kind of like a lot of people at least feel a bump in their kind of libido and just generally how they feel. It's pretty unclear whether or not it's really doing all that much. It does seem to increase luteinizing hormone, and luteinizing hormone is what sends the signal to the Leydig cells in the testicles to actually produce testosterone. But you know, it's really unclear how much, if anything, is really going on there. People are going to love this one. Looking at females bumps up testosterone levels. So you know, if you can pull up a desktop calendar that's got some you know, Swedish bikini models or something, that's been shown to be helpful. And then from there, there's just you know, this is kind of the holy grail kind of thing. There's not a ton of stuff out there that legitimately works. The problem with the hormone replacement therapy, though, is once you go on, you start to some degree downregulating your own production of testosterone. And so it becomes a little bit of a lifetime marriage with that whole thing. So you need to really be clear that you've done everything you can to shore up any problems you might have normally, and before you consider going on hormone replacement therapy, in my opinion. Dr. Colgan Institute and all that, he's very, very knowledgeable on this stuff. And so I would do some investigating on what he's written. He kind of has described at length the pros and cons of hormone replacement therapy, and if you end up opting for that, why you would do it and what other lifestyle things you want to consider to before you go that route.
All right, good question.
Yeah.
Next, we got a question from Eric. Hey, Rob, I have a question for my girlfriend that I was hoping you could answer. She has always had difficulty in getting lean. Her mother is a big fan of eating grain and vegetable-rich diets, and that is how she was raised. Now that she has control of her eating habits, she tried to reduce her carb intake after me talking about eating paleo and reading Good Calories, Bad Calories, another good book, but put you to sleep. However, when she did this, she had a big problem with an increase in stomach acid to the point of nausea. And complete loss of appetite. I think it's important to know that 3 years ago she had
Giardia
that went untreated for about 6 months, and for a couple of years after she was taking Acefex to deal with some of the fallout from that. I was hoping you could shed some light on her situation and give us some ideas of how she, parentheses, we, can eat to help her lean out and still be comfortable. Thank you.
Interestingly, I bet she is hypochloritic. I bet she's low, both low stomach acid and I would almost guarantee low in the production of or secretion of bile salts and the pancreatic enzymes. Giardia is an intestinal parasite. I ended up losing 35 pounds after I got exposed to it, and that actually really, really worsened. I think I've always been sensitive to gluten, but it was after the Giardia exposure that I became wickedly, you know, sensitive to gluten. So I would be willing to bet that she would really benefit from just that standard old Now Food super enzyme, starting off with like one capsule per meal, titrating up to two, then three, then four, until she feels a little bit of warmth in the epigastric region. Obviously, still, you know, that same thing. Andy, we need to still do a video on this, on how to do it, and then we can just refer folks to it. But always protein and fat containing meals when you're taking that Now Food super enzyme. But I suspect even though she feels like she has some you know, lack of acid production, I'm guessing that it's actually the exact opposite, that it's actually kind of a hypochloridia, low stomach acid production. I could be wrong with that, but that would be my bet.
And Rob, I would remind you that we were supposed to record that video, but we need to wait till your self-imposed book deadline, because I don't want to be responsible for Nikki burning down the house.
Or shooting us both. Yeah.
Oh, I think I'm safe. I think I'm safe because she knows I'll take care of the cat.
That's true. That's true. Keystone will have a surrogate family then. So, yeah, and you know, Eric might have her consider like still doing another what's called an O&P, an ova and parasite. It's basically a stool sample, and they check it for kind of a broad spectrum bacterial, yeast, and parasitic, you know, composition. She could have another parasite. She could still have a dormant, but or quasi-dormant strain of the Giardia hanging out in there. She would likely benefit from some probiotics Like the Giardia is gnarly, and it can cause some pretty serious damage to the GI lining. And you know, she's gonna have to get her digestion kind of dialed in first, so that she can actually eat some of these other foods. And it's that old thing again, like the soups, the stews, the curries, cooking food well, making sure the vegetables are cooked well, cutting the meat up, you know, chicken, fish, meat, cutting up small, going more for like ground beef and ground pork when you're doing meat options, because it's just easier to digest, easier to chew. Just making things easier on her digestion for a while will help a bunch.
Good. All right. And Rob, this may be the shortest episode ever, which I know is part of our plan to help you finish your book. So we're going to do one more question, and you haven't pre-screened it, Rob. It's so scary right
uh-oh.
Now.
Uh-oh. Okay.
But as Kelly Starrett says, man, this is performance art, so here we go.
If this is, it's pathetic, but we'll do our best.
Well, you realize it was after he watched It Might Be Loud, and he was somehow comparing everything in his life to, you know, legendary blues guitarist playing on stage, which I felt was a bit of a stretch, but I appreciated the sentiment he was trying to bring to life.
Kelly definitely has delusions of grandeur, but he's big, so that's fine.
Big and much more flexible than I am.
Yes, yes.
So we got a question from Patty. She says, "Hi Rob, I'm my wife, mother, and recent paleo adoptee. I'm 2 months in and feeling good. I'm one of your 6 avid podcast listeners." Of course, parentheses, your joke, not mine. "And the more I learn, the more I'm convinced of the lifestyle. As you often comment, the questions are getting more and more challenging, so I thought a return to basics may be helpful. I'm interested in living well and feeling well, exercising, but I'm not striving towards any competitive fitness goals, CrossFit or otherwise. Question 1. Glutens are obviously completely out when it comes to the borderline cheat foods like nuts, legumes, and dairy. Is it better to have a little dairy, let's say every other day, or is it better to have a true portion of dairy on a cheat day only? I know your response will be not to have any at all, but I find myself eating some in sauces or at restaurants, and I'm wondering how detrimental it really is."
You know, I don't know with that. It's very subjective, and when we say dairy, it could range anything from, you know, whole cream or like butter. I would really be kind of like, I don't really care at all, unless the individual has some sort of autoimmune thing, to like, if it's some sort of a cheese deal, then do you react to the cheese? Do you have any type of acne from it? Are you dealing with any type of inflammatory issues? If you're going out for Mexican food and you throw, you know, there's a little bit of like Tojiga cheese on your tacos, and you get that one, you know, once every couple of days or something. I don't care like that. That I'm just totally nonplussed by that, unless the individual has some health concerns. Then we would start tightening stuff up.
Yeah.
So I you know, if you like having it every couple of days, but all of those recommendations are to make your life better. If you really, really like it and you don't feel otherwise like it's causing you problems, then by all means, keep it in the rotation. What I would recommend is that thing of give yourself 30 days of none and then see how you really respond to that. And then you can kind of make a decision, okay, yeah, I can have the, you know, some sharp cheese or like some great French cheese or something every couple of days and it doesn't seem to bother me at all. Or you're like, wow, okay, yeah, I really notice that I get a little joint inflammation or something like that, and I'm going to really minimize my exposure to this stuff. And then within that, a lot of people notice that if they can track down a grass-fed variety of cheese, that if they have some of the inflammatory issues, the grass-fed varieties do not cause that in them. It still is going to have some of the insulin spiking issues, and it still might be a problem depending on what you have going on health-wise, but there's just kind of orders of magnitude of how problematic this stuff can be. So I would just recommend maybe trying to go without it completely for a month, see how you do, then reintroduce it on like a weekly level, then reintroduce it on an every couple of days level, and see how you're feeling.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the topics where I also attack it from, you know, are you happy with your level of leanness? If so, maybe you can play with this stuff. If you're not, probably wouldn't spend too much time playing with some of the dairy that's super insulin spiking.
Right. That's the other folks, you know, if you're trying to lean out, then we'll pull dairy out of the equation. Again, unless it's like a little bit of butter, a little bit of whole whipping cream generally.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to read the next question. I think we attacked it a little bit earlier, but this is a little bit different dimension. So I've been reading about the PCB issues with fish oil. I was wondering if you had any access to definitive PCB research by brand. I use Carlson, but really have no way of knowing. I've seen studies where 9 out of 10 tested have carcinogenic levels of PCBs.
I have no... We would have to do some looking around on that. I know there are some watchdog groups out there, but, you know, like a definitive compendium on that is, I don't know that one exists. We would definitely have to do some research on that. And then even then, this stuff varies from batch to batch, from, you know, seasonality, where the sourcing that they have, there's a ton of variables behind all that.
Yeah. All right. Question three, my husband is a type 1 diabetic and is living paleo now too. Any particular things he should keep in mind or do differently as a type 1er? I'm looking forward to seeing his blood work, A1C, lipid profile, creatinine level, etc. in the next visit.
She should definitely read the several posts and particularly the comments that we've done on type 1 diabetes on the blog. And one of the things to keep an eye on with the husband is the amount and type of exercise he's doing. And this is one of those scenarios where a lot of activity or a lot of high intensity activity may be totally counterproductive for the type 1 diabetic because of the hepatic release of glucose because of cortisol. You get into a stress state, the body produces adrenaline and cortisol. The adrenaline and cortisol cause a release of both lipids and glucose out of the liver. But the problem is that we don't have the lockstep release of insulin that would normally manage that. And so you can end up with sky high blood glucose levels simply from working out. So that's one thing to really keep an eye on. And then the obvious things, you know, sleep, lifestyle, all the rest of that stuff. And really keeping an eye on what you're doing such that you can try to keep those A1Cs below 5. And that is really aggressive in type 1 diabetes land. Most of your doctors and healthcare providers are okay with A1Cs that are like 6 and 7. And for me, that's you're just looking at the person die rapidly. And we know we can do better than that.
Yes. All right. Question four, advice on paleo for kids. My daughter is 15 months old and pretty much the anti-standard kid diet. And it's pretty much the anti-standard kid diet to keep her off gluten and dairy, but I do try. Need to make sure that she gets enough calories. Would you recommend rice for her? Brown rice, question mark. When she does eat some bread out to eat, would you recommend white or wheat?
Dear. The horrors. The terrors.
That's why I put this in, Rob.
Oh, man. There's just, I mean, roll however you want. I always get really nervous when the whole kid thing comes up, but just pump through a nutrition analyzer 100 calories of rice and 100 calories of yam or sweet potato. And which one's got more nutritional value? Which one is going to have less gut irritation potential? There's just no comparison. And you know, when people talk about feeding kids, they look at all the grain stuff as if the kids are missing something out of it. When you look at one of the papers from Cordain and Eaton, where they look at a contemporary diet based or a hunter-gatherer diet based on contemporary food groups, when you ditch the dairy and the grains and the legumes, you suddenly have a diet that looks like you're taking in a nutritional supplement. You know, lean meats, fruits and vegetables, some nuts and seeds. It is incredibly nutritious. Doesn't mess up their GI tract at all. Honestly, like the longer you can keep the kid off of gluten, like I would, you know, literally dive in front of a bus to keep that from happening. And at that point, the wheat, white, you know, it's all bad. If you want the honest answer, it's just all bad. And I see no compelling reason to offer it into the diet, you know, to try to make it some sort of a staple or whatever. When it pops up, then that's going to happen, you know. But so don't make the kid neurotic. Don't, you know, if they go over to a friend's house, don't make them that weird kid, because you're already probably going to be that weird kid because your family eats a little bit differently anyway. But I just, to whatever degree you can control the home environment and keep their food solid, I would do that. I mean, if you're already going this far, why muck around with the other stuff? But that's just my opinion on that. Yep. We've seen so many examples of people in the gym and then people commenting, you know, writing into the blog, just literally thousands of people now that they had a kid or two and they, you know, they fed them kind of standard stuff, and then they've had the next kid, and this kid is all paleoed out, and it's all fruit, meats, veggies, you know, yams, sweet potatoes, and the kids are just doing so much better. The digestion is better. They feel better. They don't have all the kind of wacky digestive problems, the colic and the funky poops and all that. So I it's just really hard to find a compelling reason to introduce any of that stuff.
I think I need to read the last comment from Patty, Rob, because it's just going to wrap up
your
pseudo.
Just dagger into my soul. Okay, go for
no,
it.
No, this is positive. This is positive. Okay. Many thanks, Rob. You're a brilliant biochemist and generous purveyor of information. Thanks for sharing the good word and helping us all to see the light. See, you got her snowed.
Totally, completely. Yeah, I need to. She needs to be my PR person with CrossFit Inc. So.
All right, Rob, well, we successfully navigated episode 20, so you can go back to hammering out some book stuff.
Sweet. I'm getting ready to start the supplement chapter and just kind of look over the whole ball of wax and see what pieces I need to fit in there to make it all fit together, make sure it makes some sense.
Awesome. Well, we are all getting excited, and I guess once you deliver to your publisher, we'll start the next countdown for when it's actually available in stores, but, you know, one step at a time.
We will probably within a month have a pre-sale option on like Barnes & Noble online, Amazon online, all that sort of stuff. And then I'm pretty sure what we're shooting for is like a September 1 physical release for the book. That's my understanding right now. That could change, but that should be it. And then we may have some other cool little things as some pre options with that, which I'll get more information. I'll be able to go into that deeper next time.
Cool. Looking forward to it. Well, Rob, thank you. Go enjoy the rest of your Tuesday. And what day is it? Tuesday? Monday. Wow. I don't even know where I am. And I'll talk to you next week.
Sweet. Take care.
All right. See you, dude.